I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
Great to be here, Michael.
Unfortunately, I was struck low last week, and it's taken me a while to come back. So apologies to our regular listeners, but real life intruded, Martin. But it has given me the chance to think about the state of the world in the last week. I'm no more optimistic than I was a week or two ago, but I am wondering whether it's a pretty obvious thing that that Netanyahu has done in this last week, nominate President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. What a great idea, Martin.
Well, I think there's some few precedents for this sort of thing, isn't there, Michael? It hasn't. I mean, it's a funny because the Nobel Peace Prize is ostensibly the most prestigious peace prize in the world, probably the most certainly the most famous. And there has been some, really extraordinary winners like Nelson Mandela and others that have made astonishing and profound contributions. But not every winner, Michael, has been probably notably deserving.
Well, it's worth just pausing a moment to recall why they award the Peace Prize. According to Alfred Nobel's original will, the Peace Prize is awarded to the person or organisation that has one, done the most or best work for fraternity between nations, two, contributed to the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and thirdly, promoted the holding and advancement of peace congresses. So these ideals are said to reflect Nobel's hope for diplomacy, disarmament, and international cooperation. And it seems you need someone like Netanyahu, a sort of a head of state, a member of a national government, to put you up for nominating you. But I think it's probably not the silliest thing we've ever heard, Martin, or is it? I mean, he's working on a number of fronts, the president. Iran, Ukraine, Gaza. Perhaps just looking at Ukraine, you think he's ahead of the game?
Let's walk through those and see if he's talk about the level of success. So Ukraine, he has said that he'll find the peace solution. I think it was within a day, he said, and certainly I think no one could say we're closer to peace than we were before he took over the presidency. He's got by coercion, he's got Zelensky agreeing to a peace deal of sorts, although what that peace deal is not clear. But the main man that he was, projecting himself to bring to the table was Putin, the man who started that war. And certainly, there doesn't seem to be any closer to getting Putin to peace. In fact, the attacks on Ukraine have continued unabated since that time. So that's Ukraine, Michael. I don't think we're any closer there, really, than we were before.
Well, if you just consider those criteria, not a lot of fraternity between those two nations. You don't see any abolition or reduction of the standing armies, particularly if you take into account the drones. And you don't see many, what could even laughingly call peace congresses. So, yeah, I think you're right. What about Iran?
Well, Iran, this is astonishing because we all know that Israel started the war with Iran. Now, all these wars have antecedents, and Iran has sponsored many, Hamas and Hezbollah and others. But nevertheless, this actual conflict was started by Israel. So it's the equivalent of having the arsonist thank someone for putting out the fire. But it's probably, even that doesn't do justice to the situation because Netanyahu started it, and Trump joined in and escalated it, and then demanded peace afterwards. So that was extraordinary. That's, akin to someone starting a conflict or escalating it and then stopping it and then claiming peace prize for doing so. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that we're any closer there to ongoing peace or rapprochement between Iran and Israel. I think that's just simmering hostility that's even worse than before.
Well, we're back to considering these criteria. Fraternity between nations, hard to see it. Israel and Iran, reduction in standing armies. There's a suggestion that there's not so much enriched uranium around, but even that's not quite clear, and promoting the holding advancement of peace congresses. Well, I guess there's been some discussion of sorts, but the Houthis, backed by Iran, have just blown up two commercial oil tankers in the Red Sea, Martin. It's a bit hard to see that peace has suddenly descended on the Middle East. Well, what about Gaza though? This surely is going to be the Trump card, if you'll excuse my pun.
Well, at this point in time, there is some discussion around a peace agreement in Gaza, to be fair. We're fair-minded in our analysis, Michael. I would be incredibly impressed if Trump was able to pull off the trifecta. If we saw a sustainable peace agreement in Ukraine, if we saw a nuclear weapons deal, non-proliferation of nuclear weapons deal with Iran, and if we saw a lasting, sustainable peace deal between Israel and Palestine. But I think we're a long way from any of those things. The best that's been talked about at the moment, right at this point in time, is a ceasefire. A ceasefire would still be welcome. There's talk of a 60-day ceasefire, but I'm not sure that the substantive issues that underpin that are really being addressed in the ceasefire. And both sides appear to have demands that are not acceptable to the other side in terms of a lasting peace.
You get
So
the feeling when it comes to Gaza that President Trump's doing what he's done in other places, tried to announce up front the settlement, the agreement, the peace deal, the ceasefire, whatever it might be, and somehow thinks that he's cornered, he's levered, leveraged something, these warring parties into a corner. But it doesn't seem to work that way any longer for him. It might have worked for a real estate deal that they could no longer back out, but it doesn't seem to work here, Martin. And you've got people talking about sending the Palestinians from Gaza into to Rafah and locking them up there.
there are a number. I'm not sure if that's a real government proposal, or it's hard to know. There's so many things that are thrown around in these discussions. Certainly that one about getting Gazans to evacuate Gaza and go somewhere else is a fairly abhorrent idea, and I doubt that it's going to work because that's the place they see as their home. I think it's being proposed by far right people in the Israeli government. I think that's I'm not sure it's government policy, and certainly it wouldn't be acceptable to Palestinians. But it does show you how extreme some of these ideas are that are being flouted at the moment. Around the place. And of course, there's still further settlements happening in the West Bank and other places. So the West Bank is also a fairly turbulent place. There's some indications from West Bank, some prominent groups in the West Bank are interested in making peace. Or peace should be seen as a welcome prospect for all involved. It will be uncomfortable. It would amount to compromises on all sides. But what we're not getting is a sense that there's proposals on the table for a lasting peace. Even a ceasefire would still be a step ahead of what we have now.
And then you add into that President Trump's tariff plans. They go on and on. 90 days expires, new tariffs get imposed. It's not entirely clear to me, at least, Martin, whether this is just going to be a continual influx set of negotiations. Perhaps that'll be part of his nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize, that tariffs have somehow encouraged people to come to their rational minds and put down their guns and missiles.
Here you make an interesting point, Michael, because one of the criteria for the Nobel Peace Prize is the reduction, abolition or reduction of standing armies. Everything that Trump's been pushing for amongst his allies and other nations is more troops and more spending on defence. And in fact, the subliminal thing here coming out of the US administration is in order for Australia to secure one of these deals, we've got to spend more on defence. But he's pushing a similar narrative in NATO and other places. So he wants more people to spend more on armies. Now he's got an agenda to lessen reliance on the US, which we get. I kind of understand that. But that goes totally against the Nobel Peace Prize criteria, surely.
Well, there have been some unlikely winners of the Peace Prize. We've mentioned Barack Obama. It'd only just been 9 months into his presidency when they gave it to him. He apparently was as surprised as anybody. It's not quite clear, as you say, why he got it. Henry Kissinger, who was considered something of a warmonger, shared the prize with Lee Duc Tho from North Vietnam for negotiating a Vietnam ceasefire. But Tho refused the award because of the ongoing conflict. And on top of that, a couple of Nobel Committee members walked out in protest. And then Yasser Arafat, as well, who'd been fighting with Israel for a long, long time, was there when the Oslo Accords were put together, and he was awarded it. He was quite the performer at the time, wasn't he? But one of the committee members also resigned on that occasion, saying he was the worst man ever to win. So you can just imagine what the response would be if Donald Trump were to be awarded it. You'd think it might demean the meaning of peace, Martin.
I'd be astonished. I think it's actually a bit of a play. Netanyahu does like to flatter Donald Trump, and Donald Trump does see himself as a peacemaker, which, as we've said on multiple times, that's not a bad thing, even if we're not convinced that he's got any runs on the board of substance yet. But that's not a bad thing. But even so, I think this is a fairly blatant act of flattery from Netanyahu.
It might be said, though, the more worthy you are, the less likely you are to win the Nobel Peace Prize. So there might be the reverse is true as well. Mahatma Gandhi was nominated 5 times, but was never awarded it. So go figure. So go figure, Martin. But let's contemplate, will the Australian government get behind nominating President Trump, do you think? I suppose if they can work out some tariff arrangements with him and go soft a little bit on the two-state solution for Palestine and Israel, they might get there. Are we going to give up having a strong independent stance when it comes to the Middle East, Martin?
Look, Australian government is walking a tightrope at the moment. They are being very careful about the way they speak about the Middle East. They are critiquing the most egregious acts of Israel. They are at the same time pointing out that Israel has a right to self-defense, so they are walking this tightrope. They're not keen to be too critical of either Israel or Trump's stance. I thought you saw that tightrope in action most clearly when Trump bombed Iran and there was silence for about 24 hours from Albanese. I think that he and Penny Wong really don't like the way the use of violence, if you ask them privately. I'm only guessing, Michael, but I think they're also very cognizant of the long-standing alliance that we have with the US and trying to maintain that. They're also, in addition, trying to negotiate with Trump on tariffs. So they've got these various irons in the fire, and they are stuck in the middle. And they've got people on both sides here in Australia that are advocating a stronger stance one way or the other.
I suppose it means that the federal government's happy if no one's looking at Canberra at the moment and they can do other things, what those other things might be. It gives a chance for people like Roger Cook and the WA Labor Party to shine, Martin. They seem to be setting themselves up for the next 4 years of government here. They've got minerals and resources booming, and we even got out of town football teams and other things happening here. And Roger's been accused of, well, perhaps he is a bogan, but appealing to the bogans, not only being one. What do you reckon?
Well, I thought this was quite funny. They were accused of the bread and circuses line. So, you tempt voters with lots of bread and circuses. So you offer lots of entertainment and big events and glossy things for the to attract them. And I think probably the two ones they've copped a bit of flack for is this racetrack proposed at Burswood. That's upset some punters, and bring in NRL team to Perth. Both fairly significant ventures. It's been quite interesting. The one overwhelming thing, all of these things cost money. All of these things bring some form of return. And I think sometimes we get caught up in the emotion of the things that we like and dislike. Really, state government's tourism budget should be solely, mostly predicated on, bang for your buck. If the state government's investing in something, what's the return like? How many dollars is it bringing in tourism, etc.? I do think that because we're a bit further out of the way, Michael, we've got to work extra hard to bring things to Perth, and it does make you a destination on the map. As beautiful as the rest of Western Australia is, the vast majority of tourists come to Perth. And the reason why they do that is that the links, the airport links, airline links into Perth are much stronger, and it's much easier and more convenient. So you've got to have some events, and you've got to bring people to Perth for a reason. So it will attract plenty of flak, but as long as the figures stack up really well, I think there could be a case there.
Well, one of the things that West Australians love to get visitors coming to see here is our rugged northwest. And everyone will have been following the intense international lobbying battle between the Commonwealth and traditional owners in the Burrup Peninsula's Murujuga area. On Friday, a UNESCO committee will decide whether or not to grant Murujuga World Heritage status. The Commonwealth are pushing for it. Some of the traditional owners are saying this would be an outrage given the development and the degradation that they say is going on up there. How's this going to finish up, Martin? Win or lose with the World Heritage listing?
I think there's still some water to go under that bridge yet, but it does really emphasize the pointy end of that competition between economic development and heritage. We did just talked about tourism. Not that this is entirely about tourism, it's also more profoundly about the environment. But WA does have a really pristine natural environment, and where we establish that sites have particular significance, we need to work to protect those. And I think this will be a really interesting case around its assessment and its approvals processes. As we know, the EPA has gone through some changes. West Australia's Environmental Protection Agency has gone through significant changes, and that will come under the microscope as part of this process as well.
Martin, I'm on the board of a body called the Centre for Public Integrity around the country. Some retired judges, political scientists, and others interested in integrity in government. And just before I fell ill, I did a podcast with the South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas, and I'll provide a link to it on View from the Roundhouse for people to look at. But another successful premier who also knows the values of bread and circuses, it seems, Martin, they've got the LIV international golf happening there, and they're turning over some of the public golf courses right next to the city in Adelaide to the use of LIV. You can imagine doing something like that here.
Peter Malinauskas, at least in the polling I've seen, is the most popular state or federal figure, leader in politics in Australia. So he's clearly doing some things right, Michael. And not that leadership's just about popularity, but he has been very successful in bringing events to Adelaide. Adelaide is another place, even more so than Perth, needs events to put it on the map. You've pointed out LIV Golf, you've put Gather Round in. As well, big deal, and a range of other events. And he's taking action around political donations as well, Michael, which I know attracts yours and my interest as well. So he's doing some things right there.
Absolutely fascinating. But I'll tell you, amongst the politicians who are not in favour are those at the Nedlands. City Council, who've just been sacked by the State Minister Hannah Beazley because of, it seems, their inability to function properly. Do we need local government anymore? The elections are coming up in October. The City of Fremantle Mayor, Hannah Fitz-Hardings, announced that she's running again. I get the impression that the sort of famous in recent times, Kate Hewlett, Kate for Fremantle, is not running for the mayoral position, as many wondered she might. Do we really need local government?
I think, look, good local government can make a lot of difference to people's lives. And there's the basic functions of local government, but I think that local government can also be a source of innovation. It is the level of government that's closest to the people. But because there are so many local governments, and because it's not in the limelight in the same way, it is susceptible to poor governance at times. And we have seen multiple instances of that, the latest being what's happened in Netherlands, where four of the, almost half the council, basically, four of the councillors have resigned and a commission is brought in. And on the face of it, not knowing everything about Netherlands Council, there seems to be really substantial issues which need addressing there. And that's very disappointing. I imagine if you're living in Netherlands, and there are plenty of people I know that do live in Netherlands, they would be really astonished and disappointed by that course of events. It's very interesting to see Hannah Fitz-Hardings running again locally, Michael. It'll be interesting to see if there's other competitors that emerge as well. I think there were a few probably waiting in the wings to see if she was running. Now they know the answer to that. What will their next moves be?
Well, Fremantle Shipping News will be watching closely, and in fact, we'll be interviewing Hannah Fitz-Hardings next Monday, this coming Monday. So watch out on the Shipping News for that interview, and I'll ask her the hard questions, Martin. Do we really need local government anymore in Western Australia? They don't have any significant role in planning decision making, but as you say, they're still close to the ground, and there's presumably lots of work for them to continue doing. But Martin, there's also lots of important work for you to continue doing. You don't have any students to teach at the moment, though, but they'll be back.
Well, next week's orientation week, so we're right back into it next week, and the week after classes begin again down at Notre Dame. So we'll have our hands full.
And you'll have to tell me in a forthcoming view from the Roundhouse the extent to which universities, Notre Dame included, are adapting, if that's the right word, to the new world of artificial intelligence, chat GPTs, co-pilots, and the rest of them that can assist people in becoming educated, Martin. Will that be a tough discussion to have?
I think it's already a tough discussion that's being had at universities, and a lot of energy and focus is going into that. So we might have to unpack that. That's a good idea.
Thanks, Martin. Well, have a great weekend. See you next Friday, and go the Dockers.
See you next Friday.